This is How Success Happens, where we talk to polar explorers, war correspondents, founders, ultramarathoners, authors, artists, and a range of other unique personalities to help you understand the capabilities behind how success happens.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
When I'm training for an ultramarathon, anywhere from 100 to 120 miles a week would be in my training cycle. Lots of miles.
You sold something like 250,000 books.
I'm the managing editor at entrepreneur.com and your host, Linda Lacina. Today, we're going to talk about being your own mentor. The words we tell ourselves and others have real meaning. When we find a way to cut through the clutter, that's when we have real power. No one knows this better than Robin Arzon. Hi, Robin.
Hi, how are you?
A few years ago, she worked 90 hours a week as a corporate litigator, delving into everything from SEC rules to intellectual property law. Back then, after a long day, she lived to run and cycle and move. But she realized she'd rather do all that for a living. And so she took a risk and built her own fitness brand. And she transformed herself into an ultramarathoner, cycler, and best-selling author. Today, she's also the vice president of fitness programming at the cycling startup Peloton, helping to steer programming as well as teach her own classes, sitting on a bike and yelling at people like me who live stream her class all over the country. We're here to talk about the slow work of transformation and how what we tell ourselves fits in. But first, a word from our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by BNY Mellon Wealth Management, who knows that your investment decisions define not just your future, but your legacy. BNY Mellon Wealth Management knows because they know you well. This gives them the insights to help grow, protect, and transfer your wealth. Visit their brand hub, Worth Knowing, on entrepreneur.com to learn more. Disclaimer, BNY Mellon is the corporate brand of the Bank of New York Mellon Corporation and its subsidiaries. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Linda.
All right. So we talked about a bunch of things. You are many things. I want to start with ultramarathoner, in part because I think a lot of people don't fully get the extent of what an ultramarathoner is. Can you get us all up to speed? What does that mean?
An ultramarathon is any running race that is technically longer than 26.2 miles. So 26.2 is a traditional marathon distance. Anything farther than that is technically an ultramarathon. Typical distances might be 60K, around 31 miles, a 50-mile race, 100-mile race, upwards of, you know, stage races that might be, you know, 5, 6, 7 days long.
Sure, sure. And when you're training for an ultramarathon, what does that mean? How many miles are you running a week?
When I'm training for an ultramarathon, anywhere from 100 to 120 miles a week would be in my in my training cycle. Lots of miles.
So you're running a marathon or even just training for the marathon. What is going through your body? What is going through your mind? Can you sort of explain that sort of process, how you sort of push through? Because it's a minute by minute thing that you're pushing through.
The frame of mind for an endurance athlete, whether it's whatever the modality, cycling, running, anything that's really taking your body into hours of activity in one shot, takes you to a really raw place, both physically and mentally. And in training, not only are you building your body and your muscle fibers into that mode, into that, with that finish line in mind, you're also framing your mind to just be completely savage. Like I tap into really guttural, raw places that for me, that's freedom. So training for me is the iterative process of unfolding like every layer of the onion, I guess.
Sure, sure. And what does that look like? You know, when you say you're getting into a place that, you know, you're nearly savage with your, like, what does that mean?
What does it mean? You know, it's hard for me to, it's almost like you, like people say, when you found the one or whatever, you know it when you've been there, and it doesn't actually get easier. So for example, it's all relative. Somebody might feel that at the end of their first 5K race, and it's like, oh my gosh, like I barely was able to cross that finish line. You might feel it after a tough I don't know, tennis match or something. For me, the only associations I really have are running and cycling, and particularly my most extreme have been running races. So when you are approaching mile 70 or 80 of an ultramarathon, there's almost like a transcendental state that you reach. You know, lots of research has been done into a flow state and, you know, why the basketball hoop might look to a Michael Jordan, you know, huge, you know, to make that shot. It's that flow state that we get into. And I live for that. Like, I find that that is when I am in like a figurative and a literal groove, but also there's a lot of discomfort that comes with it. So it's kind of like, there's endorphins and some type of level of elation that's actually rooted in discomfort. So it's like a weird fragmented, experience that can only be accessed through movement.
Sure, sure, sure. And how important is the inner monologue to navigating all of that?
80% of it is mental. I would say like all those hundreds of miles that I'm putting in training are for naught if I don't get my mind sharp enough to break through the barriers. There will be moments that you want to quit. And sometimes in those races, it's literally willing your next step and taking it minute by minute. And being okay with those micro successes. Like sometimes when I'm having a tough race, it feels like an accomplishment just to get to the next stoplight or just to get to the next water station or the next aid station. And that you start playing mental games. Like literally I'll just be like, there's somebody ahead in the blue shirt. I'm gonna freaking catch them. And, or sometimes it's associative, it can be associative or disassociative. So sometimes I'm trying to disassociate from discomfort and pain. And sometimes I'm actually leaning into it and saying like, this will serve me. Like I am a warrior. And the part of the mind game actually is very mantra based for me. So I have a mantra practice that I really lean heavily on in tough times doing training and in races. My mantra is I am, and it's matches the cadence of my footsteps. And that repetitive inner monologue has gotten me really far. Yeah. Literally has gotten me very far.
Miles and miles and miles, yeah, and miles and miles
and miles and miles, thousands of miles.
That's it. We talked before, and you said in part that long runs help you curate white noise, right? I really think that's such an interesting idea. Tell us more about that, and why is that so important?
I think that we're constantly inundated with so much. You know, you've got a new email alert every 10 seconds. You've got, you know, you can refresh any website, any device that you have, any platform, and you're going to have more notifications, more comments, more info. And I do find that, you know, people often ask me like, how do I tap into my passion? How do I find my thing? And, you know, alluding to my transition from law to fitness. And I say that you have to curate moments where you can actually hear yourself. So it's for some people, it's in the physicality of the thing, in the act of movement. For me, that's definitely been running. And I say curate white noise because it's not shutting everything off, you know, so you're in a sleep state. You actually need to have an awareness of your inner monologue. So I think it's not just like go and take a nap, refresh. That is a form of refresh. But what I'm talking about is like tune in, and in the footsteps of my runs, there is like kind of a cool drumbeat in that internally that I am able to actually hear myself think. Like that phrase, hear, listen to yourself think, is a beautiful thing. It can become overwhelming, but until you start to dissect that, you're not going to know who the hell you even are.
Really, really interesting. You growing up as a girl in Philly, used to say that you weren't an athlete. You didn't call yourself an athlete. Why?
Man, it's all about storytelling. We tell ourselves crazy, crazy stories. Sometimes that's for better or for worse. You know, now to motivate myself, sometimes I hop out of bed and tell myself I'm Beyonce for the moment. And I just like keep it moving. But as a child, I did not define myself as an athlete. I didn't run my first mile until law school. I used to, you know, I was allergic to fitness. Like I would just, any excuse any excuse I would give to get out of gym class. And it's ironic now that, you know, that's, I'm so in pursuit of sweat. I proselytize sweat, really. But the storytelling piece goes right back to the mind games. It goes right back to our inner monologue. Like it's how are we viewing ourselves in our own narrative, like as life is a movie. I mean, I guess there could be perceived a little bit of like artifice in that, but I don't. I see that there's a lot of authenticity there if you are actually acting in accordance with the beautiful story that you want to write. When I am at the crossroads of making a tough decision, I often ask myself, how am I going to want to tell this story? How am I going to want, you know, in 5 or 10 years to be able to recap this? Or will it not matter at all? And sometimes that puts things into major perspective. It's like, I'm probably not going to care about this in a year. This is going to be such a small part of the narrative that, like, keep it moving. So that helps me put things in context.
Yeah. And so back to this idea of sort of telling your life as a movie, right? If we're going to go back to sort of a dramatic scene from your life that I think also sort of brings the power of words to great focus. So if you don't mind, I want to talk about a time you had a near-death experience, and I'm going to read a small excerpt from a New York Times piece from the event. This excerpt from 2002 from the New York Times. Armed with 3 pistols, a 30-inch sword, and kerosene, a gunman unleashed a furious swirl of violence on an East Village street, shooting 3 people and holding patrons of a crowded wine bar hostage. So you were one of those patrons. So what were you seeing? What were you hearing? What was the scene? If you could sort of help us sort of get into that moment so we understand where you were at that time.
Sure. It was... it's so crazy that happened over 10 years ago, but it feels like it was yesterday. I was in a wine bar with my friends, and I saw a man walk in declaring that he had been shot, and I didn't see any blood. It was really disorienting. This is actually around the time that reality TV kind of started picking up speed, and I had this moment where I was like, this is a horrible joke. Like, this is such a horrible, distasteful joke. And then the perpetrator walked in, shot him again, and everything went into slow motion. A lot of people who experience trauma will recount things in slow motion, like if somebody's been in a car accident, you might recall it happening really slowly, almost like things happen in the movies. And that was very much, like, time kind of stood still, even though things were happening really rapidly. So this man walked in, shot this other person, the first victim I saw. Then the perpetrator ended up grabbing me by my hair, and he's got a gun in the right hand, me by the left hand, and he's just spewing hate and expletives, and everybody, it's just mayhem. There are stools flying over the place, bottles flying all over the place. And finally, he kind of drags a handful of us back to this kitchen area that was closed off, no doors, no windows. And he proceeded to take us hostage. And I was his main hostage, as in the person basically he was holding as a human shield. So he was holding me in front of him to protect from any gunshots that would be coming in from outside. The NYPD, of course, were called and were outside waiting to assist in the situation, but he had 20 hostages. So it was a challenging,
situation.
I think that's maybe the biggest understatement of the day. It was obviously really traumatic.
And so, just to sort of remind folks, there's been a lot of details in here. So you're 20 years old, you're drenched in kerosene.
Yep.
He's holding you, and you are the sort of the connector between him and the police outside to sort of help get everybody safe.
Yeah, I became an impromptu hostage negotiator as a kid, really, young adult. I had this impulse to humanize the situation. He had a gun to my right temple, a barbecue lighter to my left. He ended up dousing us with kerosene. He had our hands tied with garbage bag ties. I mean, it was truly like, it was like an SVU episode in real life. And I wanted to humanize the situation and really get at the power of expression. Like, I mean, I just wanted to know, like, why are you here? What do you want? And do you know that all these people have, you know, daughters, sons, parents, someone, a partner that wants them home? And this is also when I realized the power of story. My refrain, my surprising internal refrain was, this is not the end to my story. And I remember that so vividly we were going to get out of there. We were going to get out of there. And for me, a sense of calm and addressing this person as a fellow person ended up aiding the situation in ways that I didn't even know would happen. So he ended up shooting out to the NYPD and to other folks on the street. Thankfully, three or four people were shot, but nobody died. And then the situation ended when he was jumped from behind by one of the fellow hostages, and then the NYPD rushed in and he was arrested.
Yeah. And what sorts of things are you saying? Like, what types of words? I mean, you probably don't remember exactly, but like, what are you saying to him in this crazy moment?
Strangely, we started speaking in Spanish. I didn't know that he spoke Spanish, and he didn't know I spoke Spanish, but somehow, like, he started addressing me in Spanish, and I was like, okay, like, if this is a way for us to connect, let's do it. And we started talking about his family, his 10-year-old son, his, you know, his wife had just passed. Like, it was just crazy. And then I started trying to relate it to me and other people in the room, and there were people who were yelling and screaming and crying, and it was just absolute mayhem. And I guess I just kept trying to bring it back to the humanity of, like, his family, to be honest. That was the through line that I was able to find, the commonality I was able to find with him. He's in prison right now. He's still alive, and he's a very disturbed individual. So, I'm not sure how much clarity I would have even able to get into with him, but that at least nobody died.
Well, but in that moment, you're coaching him, in a way, and to show him that there's another choice.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was just this crazy mix of vitriol combined with moments of awareness and empathy. It was a really, really, for coming from his end. So that was a really, really just insanely intense time.
Well, and any moment like that never really sort of impacts us until, like, later. We don't really sort of understand sort of how things change us. But how did it change you?
I mean, you don't have a life or death situation. You don't have a gun to your face and not remember that. I know what hot metal feels like to my temple. So you never forget that. And I draw a lot of strength from that. I've had a lot of time to process it. It's actually why I started running, was to process this trauma. And I draw strength from it, knowing that through the power of words and narrative and how I view myself in the world, I could have chosen to feel victimized, but I chose to feel empowered despite the wrongdoing.
So let's connect some of these other threads, right? So you had that experience, you find yourself in law, right? You've already been running. You've had the benefit now of that inner monologue that comes from running, right? You've said that in part your inner monologue sort of helped you decide that it was time to leave. It was trying to find. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I felt like I was leading a divorced existence when I was counting down the hours of, you know, in my midtown office as a rising senior associate at a law firm. And there were moments in the runs that allowed me to really think, like, do I really want to be a partner? Like, is this really what I want to do? And it felt initially, those thoughts really felt so absurd, because it was like, you went to law school, you did all these things, like, you paid for years and years and years of schooling, you paved this road. So to pivot felt really, of course, scary. And there wasn't one aha moment. I tell people that oftentimes you're not going to have that, like, Oprah aha, like jaw-dropping moment. For a lot of people, it's, you know, death by a thousand paper cuts. And that is avoidable. It just depends on how badly you want the change. And it was a slow 2-year process where I was like, I wasn't the stereotypical lawyer who hated law. I actually found the intellectual rigor of it fascinating. And I worked with partners and clients who were some of the smartest people to this day that I've ever known. That said, there is a difference between living at a 50% malaise happiness quotient and waking up every day knowing that you're meant to be here. And that was the difference for me. And it was only through running that I was even made aware of those ideas. And I had this moment where I was like, maybe I could get, maybe it was such a simple proposition. I just asked myself, could I even pay my rent running, knowing that I'm never going to the Olympics as a runner? You know, I'm never going to win a marathon. You know, I'm not a 5-minute miler. It was like, could I have possibly a career that makes me as happy as when I go on my runs? And that crazy idea is why I'm doing what I'm doing today.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's really, really interesting. And I think what's interesting in particular about fitness, and I mentioned earlier that I am someone who takes your class. And what I think is very interesting about it is that in fitness, there are defined goals, right? There's very defined goals. Like you might have a workout. Okay, I have 30 minutes. I'm going to do this for 30 minutes. Or I know I want to lose weight. I want to lose so many pounds, whatever mm-hmm. the thing is, you can probably point to it, right? But in life, the path is not so clear, right? And you often, a lot of people have trouble as natural to figuring out what that thing is. And does that make motivation sort of even harder, right? When you don't even know what the goal is?
Yeah, I do believe that setting specific and attainable goals in the near term, couched within or under big, crazy dreams, are the best combination of both. I always tell people, like, take the calculated risk. Dream big and then establish the true underpinning of what you're going to need to get there. It's like, it's okay to want it all. Are you willing to work for it? What are you willing to do for it? That is the question. So it's like, don't apologize for being new. Don't apologize for being slow. Don't apologize for being whatever size. What are you willing to do to make the change? Those are not rhetorical questions. Like I always say on the bike, like, answer me in sweat, answer me in pedal strokes, like, pay me in sweat equity. That is what I want. So the, having a literal finish line, of course, very good. I always tell people, you know, from a training angle, sign up for your next race, like that, you know, somewhere in the distance, 3 months out, 6 months out. Like, it's good to have that refrain in the back of your head, knowing, you know, I've got a finish line coming up. But in a more abstract sense, how do you want to feel every day? How do you want to feel in, you know, at work, at your job, with your kids, with your partner? Like, then what are the actions that are going to get you there? Like, sometimes these conversations feel a little bit heady, like it's very abstract, but how we live, how we work, how we feel, like that is, those are our lives. So, like, do the actions that are writing the best story.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, what I think is really interesting, I think that when it comes to fitness, like you say, pay and sweat, right? So we understand what working hard is in maybe an athletic sense. I know I'm going to feel tired, I'm going to be sweaty, whatever. My muscles are sore, right? Maybe they cramp up, whatever. But if I'm doing some big project, right? Maybe I'm exhausted. Maybe there's a hurdle that seems sort of not climbable, whatever it is. And a lot of times people get to those moments and they'll hit a point of resistance and it's not an easily defined thing. It's not like sweat. It's not like being tired. It's this thing isn't working. And it's easy to tell yourself, well, maybe I should just quit. Mm-hmm. This is too hard. I don't know the answer. I don't know how to push back, right? And so when we go through that, you know, what is happening? Why can't we get past those moments to the things that we tell ourselves we want?
I really believe that we are riddled with excuses. And I think that most people don't even get to the point of looking over the cliff. Like, we don't even get to the cliff. And I think that that's really sad. Our reserves have reserves, and that applies to, you know, creating a new business, like having a tough conversation with, you know, your business partner, like whatever the case may be. The greater the problem, the greater the opportunity. And I do believe that if you're not feeling fear at some point in a venture or an experience that is meant to bring you literal dividends, you know, at the end of the day, you're not doing it right. Because the greatest thinkers or the people I've admired the most, like, have actually failed a lot. I think that people should fail bigger. Failure is feedback. It's a way for us to pivot and reiterate and redefine. That iterative process, that circuitous way to feel success or feel accomplishments, by virtue of that path, you just kind of get kind of used to it. You know what I mean? Like, it is similar to getting on the bike again and again and saying, like, you know what? I know this is going to be sweaty. I know I'm going to get breathless. This is going to get uncomfortable. I'm really not going to like this at the 25th minute. But then you get to the 45th minute and you're like, damn, I did that. But you know, kind of the pain or the discomfort that you're opting into. The unknown when it's an experience, you know, a tough project at work or whatever, that unknown can sometimes feel scarier because we haven't embarked on it before. But, like, eat a bowl of fear for breakfast. Ingest it. Like, just let it make you feel 99% defeated, and it's the 1% who get up again. And that's why we're running things.
No, absolutely. Well, no, of course. And I think it's really interesting. And so getting back to one of the things that I enjoy about your class are the maxims, the eat a bowl of fear for breakfast. We don't buy hustle at Whole Foods.
Yeah. Right? You cannot buy hustle. You can buy a Peloton bike, but you cannot buy hustle.
This is true, right? And what I think is interesting is that, you know, there's sort of joke motivation posters in offices all across the country and the world and everything. But people forget that they work.
Yeah.
The words we have that are available to us have the work, right? Yeah. You know, and so one of the things that happens in any kind of fitness class, right, is the sort of the check-ins, right? Okay, so like in the case of cycling, you know, check your posture, you know, check your pedal stroke, things like that. You know, is there a strategy there in regular normal day life, right? The check-in, right? Am I scanning my phone during a meeting when I should be paying attention? Mm-hmm. Am I, you know, looking at my email when really I want to be working on my dream project, you know, that I could be pushing forward? You know, I mean, what is your sense on that? You know, do we need to be taking the solutions that we expect in other parts of our lives and put them into the stuff that we think we care about?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's great utility in some of these best practices of most efficient people. You know, I like devour these, like, you know, top morning tips from the most productive people in the world. Yeah. I find that two things are related from spin to productivity. Taking it in 45-minute chunks. Yeah. You know, it's almost like, can you focus for 45 minutes and give as much power and attention and energy into the hardest task of your day? Yeah. Apart from the workout, you're going to get a lot done. So I think it's taking it in 45, 60 minute pieces of just like, I'm going in, I'm turning off my phone and I'm going in for battle. And focusing on 2 to 3 things in a 12-hour period, in a work day, rather than saying, like, my to-do list is 15, you know, 1500 things long, say like, what are the top three things that when I hit the pillow tonight, I want to say I made at least 1% progress on, and start with the hardest thing. Boom. Like you're going to get a whole heap done. If you focus on bite-sized chunks of your day that you're actually going to focus and give what you have. And in those focus moments, concentrate on the things that you're scared to do. Or frustrated to do, or whatever the pain point is, lean into it, and lean into it at your most productive part of the day. That might be evening, that might be first thing in the morning, that might be, you know, after you've had your afternoon coffee, whatever. Set yourself up for success. And I do think the best work environments honor that. So it's like, you know, with your bosses or your coworkers or people that you're managing, carve out those 60 or 90 minutes where like you are really going to go like get myopic about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think also the people to that point, I think that people forget how much control they really have, right? In the workday in office, for instance, you know, whether you checked your email at 10:30 or 11, it doesn't really matter. So you can structure where you put your priorities oftentimes. And but still listening to all this, right? Listening to all this, someone is listening to us talk and they say, oh, but you don't understand. I've got this or that. I've got to pick up my dog. You know, I've got this shift. I got this big project coming up and it's stupid anyway. And my boss is an idiot and all these things, right? There's any reason, any numbers of obstacles that people will list out before they will list out their goals, right? Mm-hmm. How can you tell that you're telling yourself the right story?
If you're leaving, I as you pose that question, I like started to hear like violins playing and like a dog wailing, like give me a freaking break. I just have zero tolerance for that. Zero. It like makes my blood is boiling. Like I just, everybody has obstacles. Everybody has like horrific things that happen. You know, we've got illnesses, we've got divorces, we've got whatever. Everybody's got, and it's all relative. You know, somebody's horrible thing might be somebody's good day, right? So like they say, like, keep your problems close to the vest. You're not going to want to trade them with somebody else's. Leading with gratitude will get you far, first of all. We woke up today, like it's a good damn day. Second, I think, how do you know if you're telling the right story? If you are leading with can't, won't, shouldn't, if you're leading from a place of no, and from with limiting beliefs, you might as well just like bury your hole and like just stay there. That's that inertia. The inertia of limiting beliefs is paralyzing. And I've been there. We've all been there. It's not that every day, 24 hours a day, you're going to have a smile on your face and be like, this is amazing. But you have to be aware when you're in that sticky spot. And ultimately, it's finding the right entry point to unburden yourself. Like for me, I unburden myself a lot in running and in cycling and in movement and in fitness. For other people, it may be reading, cooking, whatever. Like carve out those moments that actually let you release, because you're going to be much more productive in every other aspect of your life. So it's not all about 24 hours a day hustling at 100. It's about working smartly and prioritizing your story. Your story doesn't need to be your boss's story. It's part of it. You're like a Venn diagram, and that centerpiece is what you're collaborating together. But the rest of it is who you are and what your life's work is. I am lucky enough that I am my brands, and I found something that like when I'm working, I am me. And that seamlessness really helps my happiness quotient. But I recognize that not every career is like that. So it's like when you do have to have those moments of release and unloading, make sure that you're honoring that, because it's going to make you provide much more clarity in the storytelling of every other area of your life.
Yeah. Is there also just an element of just straight up honesty?
Well, that real talk, that real self-talk is goes right back to that inner monologue. I think listening to it, honoring it, and then knowing when to shut it up. So like there's an artistry, I think, to hearing all that stuff come up and then being like, oh, that inner hater, she's just a liar. So I'm just going to put her to bed right now because I'm amazing. And sometimes you have to have that like false bravado and then do the work. I think that's the missing piece. It's not like dream big and then like just dream. No, yeah. Dream big, tell yourself that you're amazing, and then do the work to feel that actual pride. Those pride moments, those confident moments, confident building moments, like, damn, they can make you, they can build a long bridge.
Yeah. And getting through those sort of hard days help you know what.
Well, you remember it. I mean, honestly, it's like anybody who's, we're so unforgiving. We have such short memories. It's like you might have won a freaking amazing award or just last week gotten a raise. But then the following week, it's like, oh, but I hate this and my emails and this and I stink. And like, it's just crazy. We have such short memories when it comes to our successes. And remember the one negative thing somebody said in a meeting or the one, you know, fragment of a conversation that made us feel less than. It's like, concentrate on your big moments, like create a mental movie reel of your successes. And I tell all of my athletes, like when you're going into race day, you are allowed to be the star of that movie. You are allowed to be big, like take up more space in the world, like be bigger. People are like, oh, but I should be humble and this. There are plenty of places to be humble. Your kids will humble you. Your place of worship will humble you. Being on the New York City subway will humble you. Like you will be humbled in life. I'm not saying that's not a good attribute, but there's a time and a place. And sometimes you just need to like hold your head up high and just wear an invisible crown and rock it. I mean it. Yeah, like, yeah, damn.
Yeah. I think that's a good place to stop it. I think that's a good place to stop it. That's all the time we have. Thanks so much, Robin, for all of your time and all of your insights. This has been a lot of fun. And to listen to more podcasts from this series, find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and follow us on SoundCloud. And before we go, one last word from our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by BNY Mellon Wealth Management, who knows that your investment decisions define not just your future, but your legacy. BNY Mellon Wealth Management knows because they know you well. This gives them the insights to help grow, protect, and transfer your wealth. Visit their brand hub, Worth Knowing, on entrepreneur.com to learn more. Disclaimer, BNY Mellon is the corporate brand of the Bank of New York Mellon Corporation and its subsidiaries.